Osho, Come Follow Yourself, Volume 4, Reflections on Jesus of Nazareth, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 3.
Bhagwan, and supper being ended, he poureth water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet, and to wipe them with the towel wherewith he was girded. Then cometh he to Simon Peter, and Peter saith unto him, Lord, dost thou wash my feet? Jesus answered and said unto him, What I do thou knowest not, but thou shalt know hereafter. Peter saith unto him, Thou shalt never wash my feet. Jesus answered him, If I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. So after he had washed their feet, and taken his garments, and was set down again, he said unto them, Know ye what I have done to you? Ye call me Master and Lord, and ye say well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, ye also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example, that ye should do as I have done to you. When Jesus had thus said, he was troubled in spirit, and testified and said, Verily, verily, I say unto you, that one of you shall betray me. Then said Jesus unto him, That thou doest, do quickly. Now no man at the table knew for what intent he had thus spoken to him. Therefore, when Judas was gone out, Jesus said, Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another, as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love for one another.
The essence of religion is paradoxical. Opposites meet there, lose their oppositeness. Contraries become complementary there, lose their contrariness. Day and night are not separate there, neither is life and death, nor the lower and the higher. The earth is the sky there, and the sky is the earth. To the logical mind, to mind as such, because all minds are logical, it is very difficult to conceive. I will read few words from A.N. Whitehead, a very perceptive man. Religion is the vision of something which extends beyond, behind, and within. The passing flux of immediate things, something which is real and yet waiting to be realized, something which is a remote possibility and yet the greatest of present facts, something which gives meaning to all that passes and yet eludes apprehension, something whose possession is the final good and yet is beyond reach, something which is the ultimate ideal and the hopeless quest. Whitehead understands rightly the paradoxicalness of religion. But he is trying to see it through the mind. Hence, his final conclusion is that it is a hopeless quest. Hopeless, because how the opposites can meet? Jean-Paul Sartre says that God is impossible, because to make God possible, opposites will have to disappear. Death and life should become one, only then God can exist. And how the mind can conceive life and death becoming one? Winter and summer becoming one, beginning and end becoming one. For the mind, the quest becomes hopeless. The modern mind is basically without religion, because the modern mind has lost the capacity, the elasticity, to be illogical. In the ordinary world, to be illogical is to be mad. In religion, to be illogical is the method. Madness itself is the method to know God. And unless you are not mad enough so that you can put aside the categories of the mind and you can look directly without bringing any concepts in between you and the reality, you can at the most know the matter, the dead part, the past, but you cannot know the real, the alive, the God. A sincere religion will always look elusive to the mind. In fact, it looks sort of craziness. Just few days before, I was reading R.C. Zahner's books. This man has tried to understand Zen, Krishnamurti, but he could not. And in the end, he has written a small poem to ridicule them. And that small poem does not only ridicule Krishnamurti and Zen, it ridicules Jesus, Krishna. It ridicules all religion. R.C. Zahner writes in this poem, he feels he is giving you the very essence of the insanity called Zen. T, he, you and me. Me is you. You is me. Life is death. Death is life. I am my husband. You are your wife. We aren't got children. They aren't got us. We are all that happy. So why this fuss? Fuss, fuss, fuss. Cuss, cuss, cuss. Total experience. Yes, that is us. He thinks he is ridiculing. He is being ridiculous himself. But this is natural to the mind. Jesus goes on saying, I and my Father are one. That means the Son is the Father. and the vice versa has never been said but should be said, only then the truth will be complete, that the Father is also the Son. If the Son is the Father, then the Father is also the Son. But then things become elusive. On this last night with his disciples, he brings this meeting of opposites, meeting of the distant and the near, to a peak point, to a climax, by touching the feet of his disciples. He is saying the disciple is the master. The master is the disciple. This is a Zen act. Without saying anything, he is saying the very essence of all religion. He is saying that I and thou are not two. He is saying that thou is me, me is thou. He is making the circle complete. The master touching the feet of the disciples is a rare phenomenon. Through this symbolic act, Jesus is taking his departure from his disciples, showing them the very essence of religion. Where the master touches the feet of the disciple, where the son becomes the father and the father becomes the son, where the night becomes the day and the day becomes the night, and opposites merge, disappear. But this is difficult for R.C. Zahner to understand. In his book, many times he calls Aristotle our father Aristotle. Must be so. Aristotle must be his father, not God. Aristotle is the logical mind. The very essence of the logical mind is that day and night are separate and they can never meet. East and west are separate. East is east, west is west, and the twin shall never meet. But I tell you, they are meeting here. They are meeting everywhere. Wherever life exists, east and west are meeting. Wherever life exists, men and women are meeting. Wherever life exists, the master and the disciple are meeting. Wherever life exists, the soul and the matter are meeting. In you, everywhere, in a flower, in a tree, in a rock, in a man, the soul and the matter are meeting. And still you go on dividing. Can you exactly demark where your body ends and your spirit begins? Where your spirit ends and your body begins? They are one. The body is touching the feet of the spirit and the spirit is touching the feet of the body. It is a circle. Jesus says many things without saying. He sows rather than saying. He is a simple man. Zen people can understand what he did. Christians cannot understand. They go on saying, our Father who is in heaven, but that is wrong. Our Father Aristotle, they should say. Aristotle is their father. The mind that divides, the mind that makes clear-cut distinctions, the mind that categorizes, puts things into pigeonholes. A very neat and clean job Aristotle has done of life. He has classified. He is the greatest classifier. But whenever you divide, something which cannot be divided, disappears. You can dissect a flower and you can come to know of what it is constituted, the matter part, but the spirit part will disappear. You will never come to catch hold of beauty. In dissection, the beauty will disappear. You can dissect a man on an operation theater table. You can dissect minutely. You can take tremendous care in dissection and analysis, but only body will be left in your hands. The soul would disappear, because in fact the soul exists in a very deep synthesis where opposites meet. Life is a dialectical process where opposites go on meeting and go on creating a higher synthesis, a symphony, a harmony. And every moment it is happening. The day becomes night every evening, and every morning the night again becomes the day, but you are blind and you cannot see it. Everywhere you can see opposites meeting, the earth reaching to the sky in the trees and touching it, and the sky is every moment pouring into the earth, penetrating it. That love affair continues between the earth and the sky. They are always in deep embrace, meeting, infinitely one. The separation is only on the surface. Now the sutras and supper being ended, the last supper with Jesus. Only Jesus knows it is the last. The disciples are absolutely ignorant. They cannot even feel what is going to happen. They cannot hear the footsteps of the future. Jesus is already going towards his crucifixion. Jesus is ready, already moving. The moment is arriving, every moment closer and closer. But they are in a way blissfully unaware. That's what is happening to everybody. Remember, death is coming closer and closer, and you are blissfully unaware. You go on making arrangements to live as if you are going to live forever. Your mind goes on planning for the future, not knowing that death is coming. Death is hiding in every bush. Death can jump from anywhere. That night of celebration, the Last Supper with the Master, who could have thought that this is going to be the last? Who could have thought that next day Jesus will be gone? There will be no more. This unique man. There will be no more this opportunity to touch God on earth. There will be no more any possibility to look from his door, to have a glimpse of the divine from his window. Eating, drinking, they were happy. That's how life goes on, eating, drinking. And every moment, death comes closer and closer. and you go on preparing to live as if you are going to live forever. The man who becomes aware of death becomes a totally different man. Then he is not always wasting his time in preparing for the future. Rather, he starts living in the present. Alas, the disciples didn't knew. Later on, they will repent and they will cry and weep their heart out. And they will think again and again. And they will move again and again into the nostalgia of the past. Jesus was so close, and they went on missing him. And supper being ended, he poureth water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel wherewith he was girded. I call this the Zen act. What is a Zen act? A Zen act is something in which you say that which cannot be said in any other way. There are things which can be said. There are things which cannot be said. There are things which can only be acted upon. Through action, total action, they can be said. There is no other way to say them. In Zen, the master always gives a certain problem, they call it koan, to the disciple to find out the answer. And the disciple goes on finding out answers and comes again and again every morning to see the master and give his answer. And the master goes on saying, no, this is not the answer. Sometimes it happens that even before the disciple has said anything, the master says, no, this is not the answer. Sometimes this too happens, that the disciple is just outside the door coming and the master shouts from the inside, no, this is not the answer. Only later on, when the disciple becomes enlightened, then he understands what was the matter. The master had given a problem which cannot be answered verbally. You can act upon it. Only action can answer it, nothing else. Because only action can be total. Have you ever watched a small child in anger? That is total action. It is not in the head only. His every fiber of the body vibrates with anger, ready to explode, red in face, as if capable to destroy the whole world. So tiny, but so full of atomic energy. Watch a child in anger, and you will see what total action is. Or watch a lover who is in deep love. The mind stops. Even the holding of the hand of his beloved. And he is saying something which cannot be said. The very touch shows something which is beyond words, then the act is total. In anger, in love, in sadness, in bliss, sometimes it happens when the action is total. Dancing, when the dancer disappears and only the dance remains, then the action is total. And a total action is beautiful, because the total action is no more from you. The moment you are total, God is flowing through you. That day the last day of Jesus with his disciples. Jesus did a Zen act. He washed his disciples' feet. He touched his disciples' feet with deep reverence. The disciples touched the feet of the Master, but their reverence can never be total. For the majority, it is just a mannerism. It has to be done. A sort of duty. They do it unconsciously. Something that has to be done, has to be done. They are not in it. When they bow down, nothing bows down within them, just the body. It is a dead gesture. For few others, it may not be so dead. Maybe a little life flickers in it. But it is not a flame of totality. The disciples must have touched many times, thousands of times, the feet of the Master. This time Master is going to touch the feet of the disciples to show them what reverence is in its totality. That moment there was nobody who was bowing down and washing. There was bowing, there was washing, but there was nobody. Because whenever you are total, the ego disappears. The ego exists only when you are partial. If you have experienced it in some way, sometime, and I see that everybody has experienced it sometime, somewhere, but because it doesn't fit with your style of life, you have forgotten. Because it does not fit with your old pattern, you don't pay much attention to it. Because it doesn't fit you, you by and by forget it, throw it into the unconscious, into the basement of the mind. Otherwise, it has happened to everybody, unknowingly, unawares. Sometimes just swimming, and suddenly you are filled with an unknown bliss. It happens only if the swimming becomes total. Then the swimmer disappears. Then the cause of all misery disappears. And then suddenly God is there. Whenever you are total, God is there. Whenever you are divided, God is unavailable. So let me say this, your totality is God. God is not a person, it is an experience. It is not waiting somewhere. You have to create it within you. God is not like an object, like a rock. Someday you find it and bring it home. No. God is an inner harmony. You have to create it to find it. It is not a search of a dead object. It is creativity. It is tremendous creativity, and there is no higher creativity than that. A painter paints a picture. A singer sings a song. And a sculptor makes an image. A religious seeker creates God. And to create God, there is only one way, to become total. So the act becomes a whole. Jesus showed them. That is his farewell. He could not have given a greater gift to them. He showed them what reverence is, what love is, how one can totally surrender. They think they have surrendered. But a disciple's surrender is a disciple's surrender. A disciple is divided. He is a crowd. Only a part of him surrenders. That part may not be even the majority. And the many other parts go on resisting. He surrenders in a reluctant way. A part goes on pulling away from the master, withdrawing. Another part goes on saying no. One part says yes, one part says no. The disciple is always yes plus no. When Jesus touched the feet, there was only yes. He gave them the greatest gift he could, the gift of reverence. I have heard once a question was asked of Rabbi Joshua ben Karha, why did the Holy One, blessed be He, choose to speak to Moses at Mount Horeb out of a thorn bush? Relevant. Why God chose to speak to Moses from a thorn bush? Could not He find a better place? A thorn bush? At least He could have found a rose bush. Why a thorn bush to choose in the first place? It has been asked for centuries, but never anybody has given such a beautiful answer as Rabbi Joshua gave. Rabbi Joshua answered so as to teach us that there is no place on this earth free from the presence of God. God is everywhere, even in the lowly, even in a thorn bush. The whole earth is holy. Why Jesus touched the feet? He could have touched their heads. Why feet? Feet is the symbol of the lowly. In your body, the lowest part. Jesus touched the feet to show that God is there also, even in a thorn bush, in the lowliest, in the lowest depth, God is there, because God is everywhere. In the darkest valley He is there. He is not only at the peaks, remember, in the valleys also He is there. And He is not only in the saints, in the sinners also He is. When you pay respect, don't be bothered to whom to pay it, because He is everywhere. You can touch the feet of a sinner, and you have touched His feet, because there are no other feet. All feet are His. Jesus touched the feet of the disciples to show them that nothing is lowly. Everything is high, and everything is superbly magnificent, and everything is divine. Wherever you tread on God. Whatsoever you do to God. Whomsoever you pay respect or become angry, you are doing it to God. He poureth waters and began to wash the disciples' feet. The feet is symbolic of the earth. It touches the earth. The head is symbolic of the sky. it touches the sky. The head and the feet, the highest and the lowest, the above and the below are the same, because only one flows. You are in your feet as much as you are in your head. Don't forget the earth. You are rooted there. Remember it. Jesus touched the feet, washed those feet. Then cometh he to Simon Peter, and Peter saith unto him, Lord, dost thou wash my feet? It doesn't look appropriate. Dost thou wash my feet? It is okay if I wash yours. You are our Lord, our Master. A question arises into the mind of the disciple. Simon Peter, one who loves, one has a little more faith than others. Even to him a question arises. Just a question. Is it appropriate that the Master should touch my feet? Few didn't say anything. They may not even have grasped the meaning of it. It was so sudden. They have even missed. They may not have been present there. They may not have been able to understand what is happening. Only Simon Peter, the man who is going to become the rock of Jesus' church, raised a question. Dost thou wash my feet? He has loved Jesus. He has respected him. But his faith is not total yet. Man of little faith, Jesus had called him. He has faith, but very little. If the faith was total, then there is no more any distinction between the Master and the disciple. In Zen, there are stories that sometimes the disciple will hit the Master. There are stories of great love, and the Master will laugh. There are stories of great faith and trust. They saw now that distinction is no more there. Now nobody knows who is who. Master is an absence of the ego. And when the disciple's ego also disappears, there cannot be two absences. Remember, absence is always one. Two presences are possible, not two absences. For example, in your room there are two chairs. Two chairs present, two presences. You remove two chairs. Now, can you say there are two absences? Because two chairs have been removed. Now there is only one absence, simply absence. You can remove 1,000 chairs, but the absence will not be of 1,000 chairs, it will be simply absence. Master is an absence, an emptiness. There is no ego in it. It is on the part of disciple that they appear as two. From the side of the Master, because he is not there, there cannot be the other. When the I disappears, thou also disappears. P. Peter loves him, respects him, but his love is not yet total. He is still present there. The disciple has not disappeared. The disciple asks, why you and touching my feet doesn't look appropriate. Remember, in love there is nothing appropriate or not appropriate. In love all distinctions disappear. Just the other day somebody had asked that, can an enlightened man love an unenlightened man? And he asked a very pertinent question, that it is said in Ramakrishna's life that he used to cry and weep for Vivekananda. And sometimes Vivekananda will not come for a few days to see him. He will go to see him. He will find out where he is. Is it possible, the questioner had asked, that a man like Ramakrishna, in love, in such love, that he cries and weeps if Vivekananda doesn't come, and he goes to search him where he is, and he becomes very happy when Vivekananda comes? And the questioner had asked, Bhagwan, do you weep for somebody? I have so many Vivekanands. If I start weeping, then there will be no time left. Hence the difficulty. I cannot cry and weep. But I cry and weep for you. Because to me, you are just potentialities of tremendous possibilities, seeds. Yes, Ramakrishna was deep in love. And I tell you, only a Ramakrishna can be in deep love. Only a Ramakrishna. The unenlightened person can pretend that he loves, can deceive himself and others that he loves, but cannot love. Love is the quality of enlightenment. It is the light that comes out of that inner lamp. That inner lamp of enlightenment. When that flame is burning inside, then the light falls outside. Wherever it falls, it is love. Jesus loved these disciples. To say that Jesus loved or Ramakrishna loved is really not a right way of saying it, because Jesus is not, Ramakrishna is not. There is only love. When Jesus touched the feet of his disciples, love touched their feet. Not Jesus, remember. Love touched their feet. When Ramakrishna went to seek and search where Vivekananda is, Ramakrishna did not go anywhere. He is no more. Where he can go? How he can go? Who will go? Love went into search. When Ramakrishna cried and tears will fall down, it is love crying. Even Vivekananda used to feel embarrassed when Ramakrishna will stand and start dancing when Vivekananda will come, and he will hug him. Even he used to feel embarrassed. Somehow it looked a little outlandish, eccentric, and this old man seems to be crazy. If psychoanalysts were present there, they may have suspected homosexuality. Because psychoanalysis always tries to explain the flower by the fertilizer. Then even the flower starts stinking. It smells of the fertilizer, remember. But if you ask such questions to me, I explain the fertilizer by the flowers. Then even the fertilizer has a fragrance in it. Jesus touched the feet, not of the fertilizer, but of the flower, of the possibility. Ramakrishna went into search. To ordinary people, Vivekananda was just ordinary, not for Ramakrishna. Something extraordinary was waiting there. It needed help, care, it needed attention, it needed love to explode into being. Jesus touched those disciples' feet in deep reverence, in great hope. He touched their feet to show them that you are not that which you think you are. You are that which you are seeking. You are my God. Those were seeds only. Jesus could see the flowering. He touched their feet. Because the possibility of the flowering. Someday or other they will explode into beautiful flowers. They will blossom. He loved them, respected them for that. For him it is already a present phenomenon. They don't know. They are unaware. They are fast asleep. The seed is nothing but flower, fast asleep and snoring. And what is a flower? A seed who has discovered himself. A seed who has come to know himself. A seed who has become himself. That's what a flower is. Even a weed is not a weed. A weed is one who is on the path to discover oneself. Even a weed has tremendous possibilities. You may not know. Even wheat was once thought to be a weed. Even wheat, humanity discovered by and by that it is nourishment. Now you cannot think of wheat as a weed. And if you find some weed in the garden, always be respectful. Who knows? They are on the way. Someday, their capacities and possibilities will be discovered. They were ordinary weed, those disciples. Very ordinary human beings, but not for Jesus. Jesus could look into their future. Their future was present to Jesus and he touched the feet of that future. Even a man like Peter could not believe, could not see the appropriateness of it. But in love, there is nothing appropriate or not appropriate. In love, everything takes a totally different flavor. Then everything is holy. Then cometh he to Simon Peter, and Peter saith unto him, Lord, doest thou wash my feet? Jesus answered and said unto him, What I do thou knowest not now. What I do thou knowest not now, but thou shalt know hereafter. Maybe it will take many lives to know what Jesus did that day. But only hereafter you will be able to know. Because to know it now, you will have to be present here and now in your totality. But then there would have been totally a different thing. Then Peter would not have felt a little uneasy about it. He may have laughed. He may even have blessed Jesus. That's what Mahakashyap would have done if Buddha has touched his feet. He would have laughed, smiled and blessed him. That is small joke of Mahakashyap touching Buddha's head and blessing him would have reverberated all over the history. In fact, that is what he did when he smiled. That his smile was a blessing, savored from the side of the disciple. But that is possible only when the disciple is not. Everything is possible only when you are not. But Peter was there. He was a man of little faith. What I do thou knowest not now, but thou shalt know hereafter. Peter trusted. Then he didn't say anything. When Jesus says that you will know, he believes he will know. Peter said unto him, thou shalt never wash my feet. Jesus answered him, if I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. But the part that believes in Jesus is not the only part in Peter. Many other parts also exist. That part which loves Jesus and has trust is not asking now. The first question was from the part that had faith. It was simply a question. How I make the difference? You just try to listen to me. First Peter saith unto him, Lord, doest thou wash my feet? It is a simple question. There is no in it. Yes has not been said, but no has also been not said. It is simply an inquiry. Doest thou wash my feet? Doesn't look appropriate. When Jesus said, what I do thou knowest not now, but thou shalt know hereafter, that part that believed and trusted became silent. Now the second question from Peter is not from the same Peter. Now he said, thou shalt never wash my feet. Now it is a positive assertion. Now it is a positive no. It is no more hesitation. It is no more an inquiry. It is a statement. This is some other part in Peter which says, thou shalt never wash my feet. Jesus answered him, if I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. So you decide. If I don't wash you and your feet and you don't allow me, then you have nothing to do with me. You are not a part with me. Why? Something very deep has to be understood. And that is, that whatsoever you call opposites in life, they are not as opposites as they appear. You love a person and you hate him also. When you hate a person, you continue to love him. You remain divided. A man who loves riches one day becomes fed up and then he renounces. Then he escapes to the mountains. Then if you bring riches to him, he will not look at them. He is not indifferent. He has moved from yes to no. Now he has moved to the other extreme, but he remains the same man. Once he was infatuated, now he has renounced, rejected. But still, he has a relationship with the riches. The relationship exists. For example, a disciple does not allow the master to touch his feet. Why? Because of the ego. It will look very, very difficult to understand, because you will say, ego should feel perfectly happy that the master is touching the feet. Yes, there are people who have that type of ego also. We will come across them. But this too is ego. That Peter says, no, I will not allow you to touch my feet. How can I allow you? I am your greatest disciple. How can I allow you to touch my feet? The ego. That I am a humble person, the humblest. How can I allow you to touch my feet? Deep down, Peter is afraid that if Jesus touches his feet, deep down somewhere, some part of his being will feel very exhilarated and happy. That is the fear. He cannot be indifferent to it. And just see, if you cannot allow your master even to touch your feet, what else you are going to allow? Peter will say, I am ready to die for you. You can kill me if you want, but I won't allow you to touch my feet. But the basic thing is saying no to the master. Yeah, you can be ready to die, because in dying you will feel very, very ego-fulfilled, that I am becoming a martyr. The mind is so cunning. But still, the same ego, the same mind is there. I was just reading a few days before, once it happened, a Roman Catholic priest and a Church of England clergyman were arguing about religion, as priests and clergymen have always argued. They have not done anything else. Argument is their life. So the Catholic priest and a Church of England clergyman were arguing about religion. They both became rather heated. And then the Catholic priest said, we must not quarrel. We are both doing God's work. You in your way and I in his. Ego is very subtle. There is a sentence of Saint Paul. Listen it very carefully. It is very dangerous. If your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals upon his head. Mind is so cunning. The first part is from Jesus. But the second part, the sentence is from Saint Paul. But the second part is from him. Jesus says, forgive your enemies, love your enemies. But Saint Paul is saying that this is a device, a strategy. If you do this, you are heaping burning coals upon his head. Do it. you are destroying the enemy this way. He will be in hell and you will be in heaven because you have forgiven him. And when he was hungry, you fed him. And when he was thirsty, you gave him to drink. Now you are pushing him towards hell. You are becoming holier and holier. And the distance is becoming greater and greater. And you can look towards him as if he is a worm. Look at the tricks of the mind. Even if you do good, your reasons may not be good. You may serve, and your reasons may not be good. It looks perfectly right from the side of the disciple that he says, I shall not allow you to touch my feet. He thinks this is how it should be. Why and how I can allow my own master, he is so great, to touch my feet? But you are denying your master. You are saying no. A disciple is a total yes. He should be. He says, whatsoever is right, you know better. You know better. If it is right, then do it. And I will be ready to participate. Whatsoever you want me to participate in, wherever you lead me, I will come with you. Because I am no more surrendered. He said, thou shalt never wash my feet. Jesus answered him, if I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. Then forget all about your discipleship. Forget all about your love towards me. Then you are no more with me. Because Jesus can understand the ego. The ego of the righteous man. The ego of the Puritan. The ego of the holy man. The ego of the saint. But the ego, whether it is of saint or a sinner, makes no difference. It is the same ego. I came across a sentence of Richard Nixon. Violence has no place in America. Anyone who preaches violence should be shot like a dog. Beware of the cunningness of the mind. This has been done millions of times on the earth. People have killed each other for love. People have destroyed countries because they wanted to help those countries to become religious. For their own sake, they have killed thousands. Remember, the real cause deep down has to be looked at and searched out. Sometimes you are humble, but the reason is the ego. Sometimes you are simple, only because you are very complex. Sometimes you renounce the world, because you are too much infatuated with it. Sometimes you donate money, because you are greedy. And sometimes you look very brave because deep down is a coward. Watch. Man can go on deceiving himself and others by posing and pretending something else which he is not. That's why Jesus is so hard. He says, if I wash thee not, thou hast no part with me. So far, he had washed their feet and had taken his garments and was set down again, he said unto them, Know ye what I have done to you? Jesus touched their feet. It is a communication of energy. It is a deep communion of energy. And he asks, Know ye what I have done to you? And they are not aware. Even if God comes and touches your feet, you may not be aware, because it does not depend on God. It depends on your sensitivity. The deeper sensitive you are, the more you will become aware of what is happening. If your sensitivity is so deep that it touches your very core of being, only then the God's touch will be felt. Then it will be a tremendous pouring of energy. When Jesus touched their feet, had they been aware, they would have seen exactly what Hindus call the rising of the Kundalini. If they were aware, they would have seen a tremendous rise, a tide of energy. Jesus was over flooding them. There are two ways to do it. The Master touches your head, then he pulls up your energy. It is a little difficult. When he touches your feet, then he forces it up, which is easier. Jesus has been touching their head all the years they have been with him. He touched their feet. From another side, he wanted to give them a push before he leaves. He wanted to let them become aware of their own energy before he leaves, because he will be gone and they will be left in darkness if their own flame is not lit. He tried to force the energy from the below and asked, Know ye what I have done to you? But they know not. They simply thought, few who had a certain love for him must have felt awkward. And in that awkwardness, they missed the opportunity. Someone who was just indifferent, neither loved nor hated, would have watched the whole thing like a bystander, a spectator, not involved in it. One who did not love him, hated him, Judas, he must have felt very good that now the right thing is being done. Judas was the only educated, sophisticated disciple of Jesus, and he betrayed. It is a symbolic thing that intellect is the renegade. Intellect is going to betray. He was the intellect of that group of the disciples. He was the most scholarly, sophisticated, educated, most articulate in logic, in thinking. But when you become too much clever, your very cleverness becomes like a smoke screen. One great German philosopher, Hegel, has written that God is cunning. When you are cunning, even God looks cunning, because you can see only yourself reflected. Know ye what I have done to you? You call me master and lord, and ye say well, for so I am. If I then, your lord and master, have washed your feet, ye also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that ye should do as I have done to you. This is that which can be said. That which can be understood only, Jesus is not trying to explain. That cannot be explained. The energy push that he gave, the arousal of energy, that cannot be said. That was felt by a few, that may have been missed by others. Now, he is saying that which can be said. You call me master and lord, and he say well, for so I am. If I then, your lord and master, have washed your feet, ye also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that ye should do as I have done to you. He is saying to them that be respectful to each other. And that is very difficult for disciples. They are competitive. And the master knows the moment he disappears, the religion will be forgotten and politics will enter. Because disciples are politicians. In the presence of the master, they may have forgotten their politics. But once the master is gone, they will forget all about the master sooner or later. And they will start fighting. Who is the leader? Who is the greatest disciple? Who is the successor? This ugliness happens to everybody's, to every master's disciples. It happened to Mahavir's disciples. It happened to Buddha's disciples. But it didn't happen immediately to Jesus' disciples. And the reason is that Jesus touched their feet. It happened later on because the disciples didn't follow. The example was forgotten. Jesus touched their feet. He was saying that you go on touching each other's feet, be respectful. And go on doing to your own disciples also, sooner or later you will become masters and you will have disciples touch their feet. Let it become a tradition. Not a dead one. Let it remain a alive current of reverence. The disciples didn't fight amongst themselves because Jesus touched their feet. But later on, mind gathers dust and forgets. Then Christianity became divided. Now Christianity has 1001 divisions. All sorts of divisions. For small and foolish things, which doesn't mean anything. Small things for which they go on fighting and creating new churches and new denominations. And if you look deep, nothing seems to be so important. Their distinctions are just foolish. Their arguments about very futile things. In the Middle Ages, the Christian theologians were in a great argument. And the argument was that how many angels can stand on a pinpoint? How many? Things like this. You can find arguments, and then you can go on arguing. The whole thing seems to be that the ego is always in search of fight, because when you fight, only then it exists. If you love, if you respect, it cannot exist. Jesus said to them through his example that don't be related to each other through the ego. Be related through love, respect, humility. Because soon I will be gone, and then there will be no one who can help you to come out of your egos. Then you will be left to yourself. Then you will have to continue something which can help you not to fall a victim of the ego. Go on touching each other's feet and do the same to your own disciples. When Jesus had thus said, he was troubled in spirit and testified and said, verily, verily, I say unto you that one of you shall betray me. For the first time, he exactly came to know who is going to betray. By touching the feet, he felt the energy. Only Judas was happy that he touched his feet. In fact, Judas was waiting for it too long. He has always been waiting. He had never thought Jesus higher than him. Deep down he believed that he is more of a philosopher, of a thinker. Deep down he used to think that he is of a deeper understanding than Jesus. And many times he has tried that. Many times he used to show faults to Jesus, that this you did wrong. When Mary Magdalene came to see Jesus, she brought a bottle of very costly perfume and she poured it on his feet. Judas immediately said, this is not right. You should have prohibited her to do that. This is not good. This is wasting. This much money could have fed the poor for many days of the whole town. Of course, your intellect will also agree with Judas. His argument is absolutely socialistic. He is a communist. He is saying rightly, and he knows more economics than Jesus. It is true. Why waste so costly a perfume? The feet can be washed by water. There is no need to pour such a costly perfume. This could have been sold, and the money could have been used for the poor to be fed in the town. Perfectly true. Argument is right. But what Jesus said? Jesus said, the poor will always be with you, but I will not be always with you. You can feed the poor later on when I am gone. But I cannot stop her, because you can only see the perfume. I see her heart. I cannot say no to her. In deep love, in deep overflowing, not finding a way how to express, she has poured that perfume. I cannot say no to her. But Jesus' argument is not so strong as Judas' argument. Marx will agree with Judas. Mao will also agree with Judas. And I don't think anybody is going to agree with Jesus. Even Christians will feel a little embarrassed about the whole thing. It doesn't fit, doesn't look good. But I agree with Jesus. He understands the language of the heart. When he touched Judas' feet, immediately he could feel his energy that he is going to betray. And he is going to betray this very day, this very night. Verily, verily, I say unto you that one of you shall betray me. Then said Jesus unto him, to Judas, that thou doest, do quickly. Why are you waiting? Whatsoever you want to do, do it quickly, be finished with it. And even then Judas could not understand. Even then Judas could not see that this man can understand by even by touching his feet. This man can understand the future. This man can see what is going to happen. This man has read his innermost thought that he is going to betray. That he has become a conspirator against him. That he is now a part of the enemy group. That he has already bargained that he will deliver Jesus to you and you have to pay for it. Only for 30 silver coins Jesus was sold. This is beautiful because this is how you are also doing. You are selling your possibility of Jesus not even for 30 silver coins. For any rubbish thing you are ready to exchange. You are ready to give your life for any rubbish thing. For a car, for a house, for jewelry, for anything you are ready to sell your innermost Jesus. Your head is the Judas. And Jesus within you is every day crucified. Sold in the market, bargained, for nothing valuable. But only people repent later on. Even Judas repented. After Jesus' crucifixion, the next day, he killed himself, committed suicide. Because only afterwards you become aware what you have done. Just for 30 rupees, 30 silver coins, and you have sold this greatest man ever. But only later on, at the time of death, when you have crucified your Jesus completely, then you will repent and you will cry. And then you will see that what you have done to yourself, to your God who was hiding within you. Then Jesus said unto him, that thou doest, do quickly. Why he said this? He said this as a last opportunity to make him aware that Jesus is aware. But he will not understand. As if he has decided not to understand. If you have eyes to see, you will find God everywhere. Good everywhere. Scriptures in silence and sermons in stones. But if you don't know how to see, or you have lost the capacity to see, or you have forgotten how to open your eyes, and for all practical purposes you have become blind, then even when Jesus is standing before you and the door is open, you cannot see. If you can see that even in the rock the door will open and you will find God there. If you cannot see, then even in Jesus, where God is dancing just in front of you, alive in its infinitude, but you cannot see. Judas missed. And remember, there are more Judas in the world. The majority consists of them. They may call them Christians, that doesn't matter. The majority consists of Judas. The followers of Judas are millions, and it is rarely that somebody follows Jesus. Very rarely. Because to follow Jesus, you have to lose yourself. You have to pay the cost. You have to pay for it by your own life, your very being. But to follow Judas, nothing is asked. It is free of cost. In fact, Judas promises you many things that you can get if you follow him. Jesus simply says, lose yourself. And then everything will happen. But losing yourself is the beginning. Judas says, I will give you everything and you need not lose anything. The cunning mind agrees with Judas. Only a trusting heart can agree with Jesus. Then said Jesus unto him, that thou doest too quickly. Now no man at the table knew for what intent he spake this unto him. No other disciple could understand why. Why he said suddenly to Judas, do it quickly if you want to do it. Don't wait, for whom you are waiting. Why Jesus said it, no disciple could understand. Because no disciple was in the present. Otherwise they could have seen. No disciple was perceptive enough. Otherwise they could have understood. Therefore, when Judas was gone out, immediately Judas left. Jesus said, now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. Now is the Son of Man glorified, because now he is going to be crucified soon. The Son of Man is glorified only when the ego is crucified. The ego has its ways to protect itself. In one way you stop, it finds another. It goes on and on and on, unless you look so deeply that you can see all the ways of the ego in one glimpse, in one lightning glimpse. You can do one thing and it starts flowing from another. I was reading a story. A tomcat, which was always out at night, caused the neighborhood great annoyance because of the noise from his revels with the female cats. The owners eventually had him doctored, but were disconcerted to find that he still stayed out all the night and that the noise continued. So they went to the veterinary surgeon to complain about the ineffectiveness of his treatment. Nothing unusual, came the cheerful reply. You see, he now acts in a consultative capacity. If you cannot be active, at least you can be consultative. If you stop one door of the ego starts opening another. You have to see the subtle ways of the ego in a lightning flash, so totally that all its cunning subtleties are seen. In that very vision, in that very fire of a sudden lightning, the ego disappears and leaves no shadow behind, no trace behind. Now is the man glorified, the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. Why both together? Because crucifixion is a meeting point, it is a crossroads. The ego disappears, man is glorified, because man becomes pure when the ego disappears. But immediately the ego disappears, God is there, and God is glorified. The ego functions as a double-edged sword. On this side, man becomes pure. And in that purity, innocence, God is revealed on another side. And the whole thing is, the whole religion is how to drop the ego, how to become so aware, alert, that the ego cannot deceive you. Let me tell you first what ego is. Everybody is born without the ego. When a child is born, he is simply consciousness, fluid, flowing, lucid, innocent, virgin. No ego exists. By and by, the ego is created by others. The ego is the accumulated effect of others' opinion about you. Somebody comes, a neighbor, and says, "How beautiful a child," and looks with a very appreciative look at the child. Now the ego is starting functioning. Somebody smiles, somebody does not smile. Sometimes the mother is very loving, sometimes she is very angry, and the child is learning that he is not accepted as he is. His being is not accepted unconditionally. There are conditions around. If he cries and weeps and visitors are there in the house, then the mother is very angry. If he cries and weeps and there is no visitor, the mother doesn't bother. If he does not cry and weep, the mother always awards by loving kiss, caressing. When the visitors are there, if he can keep quiet and silence, the mother is tremendously happy and awarding. He is learning others' opinions about himself. He is looking into the mirror of relationship. You cannot see your face directly. You have to look in a mirror. And in the mirror you recognize your face. That reflection becomes your idea of your face. And there are 1,001 mirrors all around you. They all reflect. Somebody loves you, somebody hates you, somebody is indifferent. And then by and by the child grows and goes on accumulating the opinion of others. The total essence of the opinion of others is the ego. Then he starts looking at himself the way others look at him. Then he starts looking at himself from the outside. That is what ego is. If people appreciate and applaud, he thinks he is perfectly beautiful, accepted. If people don't applaud and don't appreciate, reject, he feels condemned. Then he goes on seeking ways and means how to be appreciated, how to be assured again and again that you are worthy, that you have a worth and meaning and significance. Then one becomes afraid to be oneself. One has to fit with the opinion of others. If you drop the ego, suddenly you become a child again. Now you are not worried what others think about you. Now you don't pay any attention what others say about you. Not even a bit you are concerned. Now you have dropped the mirror. It is pointless. You have your face. Why ask the mirror? And there are many types of mirrors. Some make your face look long, some make your face look big, some make your face look small, some make your face look horrible, distorted. Don't ask the mirror, because then the quality of the glass will always be there in the reflection. And there are millions of mirrors all around you, millions of relationships, and you go on gathering. That's why ego is always inconsistent. It is a crowd. It is a heap with no inner coherence. Somebody says you are beautiful, and then somebody says you are just homely, and somebody says you and beautiful you make me feel horrible, terrible. You are nauseating. You and beautiful, you are a nausea. I feel like vomiting whenever I see you. Now what you do? You collect all these opinions, inconsistent, contradicting each other, and they all become part of your ego. Ego is a crowd. It is a marketplace, because you have gathered it in the marketplace, because you have gathered it from the crowd. It is not you. It is others' opinion about you. Why be bothered? Drop all opinions of others about you. Why not be direct and immediate? Why not see within yourself, in your own nature? Why not face yourself? Why bring a mediator, a mirror into it? When you start with closed eyes looking into your own nature, you are moving beyond the ego. And once you know who you are, even a slight glimpse, then you will start laughing at the whole ridiculousness of it, that you were asking others, who are you? They don't know themselves who they are. Why ask them? You become free. A freedom is attained. Without the ego, you come back to your own nature. Jesus said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another." Love is the essential message of Jesus. But it has been lost in arguments, debates, discussions, conflicting philosophies. wars. I would like to tell you one anecdote. One day, a little boy asked his parents, "How do wars break out? How are they declared?" He was reading a book of history, and a book of history is nothing but wars. Ugly wars. That is all your history is. The boy became worried, anxious. Why wars start? How they start? He asked his parents. So the father, who was very learned in political and economical affairs, started talking about the economic causes of wars. But the mother thought that the little boy was far too small to understand such complicated things. And she said, "Let me explain it." The mother began to explain, and the father became very angry, grew very angry and hostile, because he was going to teach the child, and the mother jumped in. And a great argument developed. The little boy was very much frightened indeed, and held up his hands and cried loudly, "Stop, stop, now I know how wars start." Once you create a philosophy, an opinion, you are already on the war path. If there is ideology, there is going to be fight. And this is the predicament, that there are people who want the world to be without wars, but they have ideologies, and their ideologies create wars. There are communists who go on arranging peace conferences, and they have a particular ideology, how the world should be and how the society should be. And there are Catholics who go on talking about peace, but they have an ideology. And there are Hindus who go on talking about peace, but they have an ideology. There are even Jains who talk of non-violence, peace, no war, but they have an ideology. And if you have an ideology, you are the cause of war. A world without wars will be a world without ideologies. A world without wars can be based only on a non-ideological love. Love is not an ideology. It is not a theology. It is not a philosophy. This is, Jesus says, is my new commandment. A new commandment I give to you, that ye love one another as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one to another. Verily, verily, I also say unto you, that only those who love are Christians. Catholics cannot be Christians. They are against Protestants. Protestants cannot be Christians. They are against Catholics. Christians cannot be Christians. They are against Hindus. Hindus cannot be Christians. They are against Mohammedans and Christians. To follow Christ, one has to follow love. This is his new commandment. Follow love and forget everything. Everything is irrelevant. Only love has relevance, because only love leads you to the divine, Only love leads you to the temple of the God. Make love your only and the only commandment. There is nothing else. If you follow love, everything will be set right by its own accord. One man came to Saint Augustine and asked that just in short you give me the very essence of religion, because I am not a learned man. And don't make it very complicated, and don't give me many commandments, because I will get confused. You simply say me one thing, just a key word. Saint Augustine said, then that word is love. You love, and don't be bothered by anything else. If you love, everything falls in a step on its own accord. Let love be your God. Let love be your only commandment. Let love be your religion. Please remember, don't make an ideology of it. Act in a loving way. Be in a loving way. Don't create a philosophy around love, because that will create wars. A peaceful world is possible if love starts throbbing in the heart of man. Man has been so inhuman to man in the past that even animals look like angels in comparison. Because up to now we have only talked about love, we have not loved. Now let us love and forget all talk about love. Lovers are needed. And remember one thing which Jesus says, because you may not have listened it. A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another. And now comes the most important clause in the sentence, as I have loved you. How a Jesus loves. His love is unconditional. He loves. He loves you without any expectations. He loves you just because you are beautiful. Not that he has some expectations from you. It is not that you have to be in a certain way, then he will love. He simply loves you because you are. Because you are God. You are God's. You are already worthy. Whatsoever you are, you have a worth of tremendous value. Otherwise God won't allow you to exist. So Jesus says, as I have loved you, be in the attitude of unconditional love. And remember, only unconditional love is love. Love conditioned is love corrupted. Love unconditioned is the vast sky of being. It is another word for God. Enough for today.